Welcome to another episode of It's Not Brain Surgery, the WNS Practice and Business Management Podcast. I'm Paul Camerota, your host for this episode, and we are really excited to have with us today Dr. Chirag Upadhyaya. Dr. Upadhyaya is Clinical Associate Professor of Neurosurgery at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He serves as the Chief Transformation and Business Strategy Officer for the Department of Neurosurgery there. He's completed research fellowships at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, the NIH, and as a Robert Woods Johnson Clinical Scholar. He finished his residency at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and then completed a fellowship in complex and minimally invasive spine surgery at UCSF. Most recently, he's also completed his MBA at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and been awarded the Scoliosis Research Society Edgar Dawson Traveling Fellowship. He has been extremely active with the WNS CNS Spine and Peripheral Nerve Outcomes, and he won a Joint Section Outcomes Committee Award. He's a member of the Scientific Program and Executive Committee for the Joint Section, serves on the Editorial Board of Journal of Neurosurgery Spine. These are just some of the accolades for Dr. Upadhyaya, I'm sure well-known to many of you. Thank you very much, Chir, for joining us on the podcast.
Well, thank you, Paul. Thank you for having me. And thank you to the WNS for sponsoring and supporting this important effort.
So today we're going to hear about communication tips, or it's kind of, we've been in this series of how to communicate the last few weeks on the podcast. And our topic today is healthcare finance basics, how to speak the language of administrators. You've been in administration in your career. And tell us some of the common communication pitfalls between neurosurgeons and their administrators. Open-ended question.
Yeah. Open-ended question. Yeah, I think, and you know, I love the podcast format, Paul, because I know you live in a similar space as chair of the Department of Neurosurgery at the University of Kansas. And so I'd love to get your perspective as well as we're chatting on this. A few things that have come through, at least as I've had the privilege of having various positions in my career. I think the first is, it's really one of self-reflection as a physician, as a surgeon. I think a lot of what we do is directed by what we do, right? In terms of, we see patients, we make a decision with our patient, we operate as surgeons on the patient. And when we do so, we're really driving the team forward and helping make those decisions as we care for our patients. I think when we're partnering with administration, I think it's a different relationship, right? And we have to sort of position ourselves in terms of how we're thinking about that relationship different than what we do in our day-to-day practice, right? Where we have to start thinking of our administrative partners, as members of a team, whereby we have to engage them, work with them, understand that they themselves have important stakeholders that they're responsible to, and that the decision to move forward is often one of collaboration and teamwork rather than something where we ourselves are able to move it forward like we do in the clinical realm. So that's one thing that at least I found. And I think it requires patience. And unfortunately, I don't know if the experience at KU is different, but my experience is one where it often requires patience, engaging a lot of different stakeholders or thinking about a lot of different stakeholders, and then tying some of the issues to the overarching mission, not only of the department, but the health system as a whole.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. Neurosurgeons tend to be, you know, leaders all through, you know, if you search back in your high school and college careers and, you know, residency. And nowadays, we used to think of administrators, I know I did, as kind of somebody that worked for you. Now you work for them. And it's almost like they speak a different language sometimes, you know, clinical FTEs and time. Like sometimes you feel like you're just pegs in a pegboard that they have to, I'll give you an example. I mean, we're trying to arrange our clinic schedule. And, you know, in the past, we would say, okay, here's my schedule. I'm working from this time to this time. I'm taking lunch here. I'm taking off Tuesday afternoon. I've never done this, but I know a lot of folks, I'm taking off Tuesday afternoon, whatever. It doesn't gel anymore. The administrators look at you and say, you have X number of blocks. I don't care what you want to do. You need to see people in 4-hour blocks on this day, 2 4-hour blocks. And it's hard to get used to, really is.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that. Actually, so I recently was tasked by our department chair here at UNC with serving in the role of vice chair of clinical operations on the outpatient realm, right? And so that's exactly the type of thing that I'm now thinking about over the last few weeks as I'm moving forward in this new role. And it's definitely challenging. It's definitely challenging. And I think it's interesting. One of the things that, going back to your first question, that I've come across is understanding the language, right? Yeah. And the language is so important, right? Because I think a lot of the things that happen is get into a lost in translation problem, right? Where we're talking one thing, thinking about it from the perspective of our patients. You're right. The administration is thinking about things like slot utilization, block utilization, if you're talking about the ORs.
Sure.
And some of the variability that actually drives good outcomes is sort of driven down into these templates, right? And so one thing that at least I've tried to do is spend a lot of time understanding that language, right? And being able to communicate with my administrative partners, respecting where they're coming from. You know, I get where they're coming from, right? But then trying to work with them to also respect what our clinicians, our surgeons need, right, to be successful, which is often a little bit of variability, actually. I think it's actually one of the things that I've tasked when I was meeting with folks here is that we don't want to try to, we want standard work where it's appropriate, but there's going to be other areas where standard work is actually not going to be very helpful, right? It's actually going to drive frustration rather than good clinical outcomes.
So talk about that for those who don't understand or are young and haven't been brought up in Six Sigma or Toyota, you know, work plan, the concept of standard work and why variability is often not good.
Yeah.
At least from an administrator perspective.
I think a lot of this actually does come from whether it's the Toyota production model, right, of trying to think through how to make a car, right? And the idea is to eliminate as much variability in the process of making a car so that the end product has as few errors as possible, right? Now, the Toyota model is interesting. The idea is that anybody on the line that's making the car is able to stop the line when they see a problem, and then everybody comes together right then and there to address the problem so that there are no more problems at that point, at least for that particular issue, right? And then on goes the car, right? Or Six Sigma, which is like, we're going to have such a small error rate, right? Hence the Six Sigma, that we're way beyond two standard deviations and so forth, right? I do think a lot of that is driven by the idea of trying to minimize variability in production so that you can then really identify how to move things forward. Perfect sense when we're talking about making a car, right? Or if you're GE, who popularized much of the Six Sigma logic, right? If you're making jet airplanes or jet engines, I should say.
Sure, right? Yeah.
I think the challenge we run into is that our profession is one primarily of knowledge work, right? And that you, for example, are tasked with seeing patients in clinic, and you are the one making those clinical judgments, right? And so I think allowing you to function as you function best is actually the task that we have to give you, right? And then allowing somebody else to function as they see best is the task, right? So we may have standard work when it comes to how we structure pre-authorization, you know, requests that go to insurance companies. We may have standard work when it comes to how coding feedback loops are structured, whatnot, right? But I think when it comes to how you run your clinic, we want to be able to celebrate and give you that variability that you need because your patients are going to be different, right? Each patient, each operation, as you know, is going to be a little bit different. So I love the concepts. I just think that they're being misapplied in the healthcare space, trying to force a manufacturing process onto what is essentially knowledge work, right? And I think it's to the detriment of physicians' ability to do our job, to detriment of physician satisfaction, and frankly, ultimately, patient care.
So you talked about the language being different, and it seems oftentimes that, I'm sure administrators think of us this way, but it seems as though they're tone deaf. We got a new contract here a year or so ago, and they mentioned something in the thing like, well, the only thing we changed is every time that it said physician or faculty, we changed it to employee. And it's like, we're no longer professionals. We're just working for the man. I mean, how do you communicate both with administrators, how your colleagues feel, and then subsequently, what kind of education do you do or is needed for the rank and file neurosurgeons on what the administration is saying?
Yeah, let me start with the second part. I think communication, you know, working with, talking to your senior partners, talking to folks like yourself, right? Senior neurosurgeons around the country who have held administrative positions or who have administrative positions is very valuable, right? It mm-hmm. just to get perspective on the process, perspective on the language, the arguments, the conversations that can be used to help drive forward patient care, right? And as you mentioned, I recently got an MBA. Is an MBA absolutely necessary? No, I don't think so. I do think it can be helpful when you're a younger mid-career surgeon as a way of validating your interest, having a stamp, if you will, and frankly, coming to the table, at least again, as a younger mid-career surgeon with some modicum of credibility. But I caution surgeons from thinking that an MBA is like an MD. It's not. It's not a license to manage. It's just a set of tools. And frankly, like what we do as surgeons, you have to practice those tools. If you don't practice and open yourself up to M&M, if you will, understanding where you made mistakes, you know, in management, it can be a problem, right? So that's my advice for some of the younger folks. To go back to your first question, I think it can be challenging. I think sometimes it's worth thinking through arguments and approaches. I'll give you a story. So when I was a resident, Michigan has a house officer association, essentially a union, right?
Wow. And that was incredible.
It's Michigan, right? Michigan,
right? That's right. People's Republic. Yeah.
And I was president of the House Officer Association. And this is, I'm going to date myself a little bit, but this is in the era before cell phones had the same level of sophistication, right? Mm-hmm. So you had to pay men or minutes and, you know, so all of the above. Sure. So I wanted to advocate for the house officers to get what we had at that time was voice over IP, right? So you mm-hmm. could have the nurses call you and you could reach out and, you know, and things like that.
Right.
And we talked to IT and could not figure out a way to articulate. We argued patient care. We said the bedside nurse can call the surgeon, you know, you can call, you can. None of it carried any weight, none of it, no matter what we did when it came to patient. But we flipped the argument and said, well, we get, I don't know, 50 pages a day. And those 50 pages, by the time you answer the page and all this, burn up about 5 minutes per page. So we're burning, you know, however many minutes is going to be spent. And we believe that with voice over IP, we can cut that in half or more because it's almost instantaneous communication. And I kid you not, Paul, we got the voice over IP phones literally the next week.
Wow.
And so that's what hit me as a lost in translation, right? We were talking, he had a very analytical framework, right? The patient care just did not resonate because they're not on the wards. They're not seeing patients. Yeah. But the minute you framed it in an argument that they live and breathe every day, right? It resonated and they approved it. It was done.
Wow. Well, along those lines, how would you recommend that neurosurgeons better communicate their value to hospital administrators?
Yeah. So I think we have to speak in the language that we have to start learning that, right? So we have to frame it in, we have to think about what are the things that are driving some of the conversations we're having. We talked about some of that today, right, Paul? Like, I'm sure you have to answer questions about slot utilization. You have to answer questions about time to access, right? What's the third night available? So I think learning about those, what are those things? What are the drivers of those things? You have to start understanding things along case mix index, right? So neurons have a very, very strong argument to demonstrate value when you think about case mix index, right? Mm-hmm. Or the hospital. When you talk about the revenue and the contribution margins that we bring with the cases that we do, when you think about how you can think value analysis, right? You can bring value. If you have 20 different spine vendors at your institution, perhaps you can consolidate that to 5, right? And still have the mm-hmm. same thing and help save money, right? So I do think there's a lot of different avenues with which you can do that. And we enable other specialties to do better, right? Because neurosurgeons are there, radiation oncology can do more. Because neurosurgeons are there, medical oncology can do more. They can take care of more patients and more aggressively and so forth. So I think depending on your institution, right? I mean, all of these things apply to what you do at KU, but I think some of this is going to be true for all of our members, right? AANS members, regardless, whether you're in a smaller community practice, whether in a big community practice or an academic practice.
So one thing we started here probably 8 or 9 years ago is teaching our residents about BRVU, our BRVS system, RVUs, CPT codes, E&M codes, all of that. It's almost as if we ought to talk to our colleagues about here are the words that you need to learn about the new normal, or maybe the AANS or an organization like that needs to get out there and say, here is value-based compensation. Here is what block utilization is and CFTE and all of these words that you and I know, but I don't know a lot of my colleagues are familiar with when I bring them together and say, hey, look, I know you like to sleep in the morning, but you got to start your clinic at 8 because there's got to be 2 4-hour blocks, mm-hmm. et cetera. But I mean, it would be good to prepare, especially residents, you know, young residents and young neurosurgeons for these sort of things coming down the line. It's almost like you need a thesaurus or something with all of these terms in it to familiarize us.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more, Paul. I mean, it's funny, I'm starting to focus on coding for our residents here at UNC so that they start understanding that terminology. I know the ABNS has started mm-hmm. a few years back, including coding when it comes to board case submission and so forth. And I think that's been a really wonderful effort on behalf of the ABNS to help drive this conversation. I spend a lot of time teaching coding to that point. But I agree. I think expanding the work, I mean, this podcast and related podcasts exactly are the type of thing that I believe is going to be valuable for our members as well as the residents. And you're right. We've got to start at the resident level so that these folks are graduating, becoming attending neurosurgeons with a baseline level of knowledge, because it's a different world. I mean, I suspect when you started your career, it was predominantly private practice neurosurgeons.
Yeah.
You set up your own shop and you had a different skill set, right? How to run a practice, pay employees and so forth.
Right.
Very challenging. I imagine you had very challenging experiences when you're
running. Yeah. And you know, the reason, you know, a lot of neurosurgeons now work for someone else, for a large organization, is it's a huge trade-off. You know, they take care of your EMR and your liability and your employee HR and all of that. On the other hand, you have to toe the line and work as a member of a very large group, you know, to their stipulations.
Yeah, there is a trade-off. I think that's the absolute right word. And I mean, I'd be curious your perspective, because you've lived in both realms.
Both worlds, right? Yeah.
That's in right. Both worlds. I'd be curious your perspective on that trade-off. I mean, would you want to go back to, or do you think that the trade-off has pluses and minuses no matter what realm you live in?
Yeah, I mean, we've interviewed a few other folks on the podcast who are in some large, you know, private groups, even large sort of privademic groups, and who are managed by or strongly led by surgeons. And they've been able to keep the physician or the physician-patient relationship largely intact and keep what we do as patients at the center of the mission, which I'm not saying we don't. Obviously, our health system does that. But I don't think I would go back. I think we're just living in a new normal, and we have to always keep the patient and patient care, great patient care, at the center of our mission, and just make sure that the administrative leaders understand that, they fortunately do it at my institution, and that the corporate welfare doesn't become the overriding mission. And I think, I mean, there were things that were good, very good about living in a private practice model like that. I mean, we hired our own people. We knew exactly who we were getting. We ran our clinics as we wanted to. We, were members of various hospital staffs. But then there were the immense headaches of the electronic medical record and the cost of that and the HR, et cetera. So certainly a trade-off. I don't think I would go back. I think we just got to keep the mission focused and do my own personal,
No, I, you know, I've had the privilege of living in the employed model of one sort or another, right, for my career. My wife is a cardiologist, and she had the private practice realm for a while, and then also the employed model, and now the academic model, right? And all I've seen is trade-offs there. Yeah, it's, I would say none of the models are perfect. None of the models are perfect. Yeah. But there is some value in economies of scale, right? And I do think you see this in some of the private practices, the larger private practices, and neurosurgery becoming bigger, but again, I think for the economies of scale as a way of managing their labor costs and so forth.
Well, Chair, thanks for being with us today and sharing your wisdom on this topic that many neurosurgeons really need a baptism of fire and education on. I usually close the podcast, I know you're a sports aficionado, with one final question, and that would be Tar Heels or Wolverines?
Wolverines.
There you go. Died in Wolverines. The
world. Wolverines. Although I will wear my, I've gone to many Tar Heel basketball games, and it's a lot of fun. But
oh my gosh, yeah.
But my heart stays with Wolverines.
With Michigan. All right. Chirag Upadhyay, our guest today on the WNS It's Not Brain Surgery podcast. Thanks again very much, Chir.
I appreciate it, Paul. Thank you.
Stay tuned to future episodes. We still have a few podcasts to get out to you on communication tips. Coming up, Dr. Stacy Wolf and communication tips giving and receiving feedback. So we really appreciate you continuing to listen. This is Paul Camerata for the WNS podcast. It's Not Brain Surgery. We'll talk to you next time.